You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Nikki Kolula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have a very, very talented singer-songwriter, Miss Lola Christine. How are
you? Hello! Thank you for having me on the show tonight.
Of course. You know what? It's like I meet a lot of songwriters, and not many of them blow me away like you did when I checked out your music. It's like you hear, you like meet songwriters, especially something like Nam, and you're like, all right, cool. I'm going to check out your music. You are the real deal. So tell me, I want to know so much about your story. I've got so many questions.
Oh, cool. Perfect.
What was the moment of Zen? We'll start with the very beginning. What was the moment of Zen that made you want to be a singer, that made you fall in love with music?
I was 9 years old, and I was a very shy, quiet little girl. But my choir director at the church I was at, she just like believed in me, and she really like, she saw something in me. And so she gave me the big solo at Christmas Eve Mass at this Catholic church. And anyone who's Catholic knows Christmas Eve is like the biggest night of the year.
What city was this, by the way?
St. Louis, Missouri.
Ask if it was St. Louis. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Very Catholic city.
Right.
And so I was terrified, but she believed in me. And so I went up there to sing O Holy Night. And I just remember like getting up to the microphone, and then it was almost like something else took over my body. And I was just like, channeling this huge big energy through my body, and it was like I blacked out. And then when I ended the song, everyone was like going nuts in the church and clapping, and I was just like, that was the best feeling of my whole life. I want to do that all the time. And and then I was addicted to singing and performing, and yeah, That was where it snapped for me. Like, I'm meant to be a singer.
How old were you? Were you like eight or nine?
9 years old.
So you must have been, you were a soprano, I assume.
Yes.
And then did you sing like mostly like religious music, or did you start doing secular music right away?
I'd say mostly singing in the church, right in the beginning. My voice teacher actually trained me and my older brother, who was a pianist, to be wedding musicians. And so I started gigging when I was 10 years old.
Wow.
And me and my brother were like this little duo, and people would hire us to sing their weddings in the Catholic church. And yeah, so it was pretty wild being a 10-year-old and having like the responsibility of singing someone's wedding.
You know what? That what's shocking about that? Like, what songs were you learning? They're probably way beyond your
like. Ave Maria, you know.
So you're doing classical music. You were doing all classical music.
Mix. Some people would want to hear like pop tunes. You know, like more modern kind of. Like, you raise me up so I can send no mountains.
You sing that back to Josh Groban. Thank you very much. You should definitely be singing that song a lot more than Josh Groban should. So I love the way you just sang that.
Oh, I love all of that music. Well, the epic ballads.
Definitely like soulful, uplifting, spiritual, all of those. When did you start like falling in love with playing instruments and writing songs?
When I was 12 years old, I started, I guess the first thing I was doing was more like writing poetry. And then I would kind of be singing these poetic lines into melodies. And then my piano teacher, she was cool enough to like start teaching me chords instead of just the traditional classical route, right, because she knew what I was really interested in. And so once she started teaching me chords, it was like, oh, I can put like this D major chord under my little da da da, my little melody. Oh, and then what chord would fit with this melody? And I didn't, you know, I had very limited knowledge at the beginning of chords, but I started naturally gravitating towards like seventh chords, ninth chords, just like weird jazz chords, because that's just like what I heard in my head. And I didn't even know what I was playing. So I'd like write out like E flat, G, B flat, D flat, F. And then, you know, like have to write out the whole stack so that I'd remember what I did.
I've done that many a times, just because I also didn't know, oh, am I playing the seventh? Now it's like you're just looking at more chord names than anything, just to get like, you know, an understanding of what you're playing. We have a parallel because I started in the church too. I started like a Episcopalian church choir, and I actually started singing in a professional children's choir when I was seven.
And dang!
Same choir that Billie Eilish actually came out of. So I was one of the youngest members of that group when it was starting. And we started doing all these crazy gigs where I was like singing at the Grammy Awards by 11, singing at Carnegie. And, but it was all choral music and I would get solos, and it was just like this thrill. But I love, and I'm envious that you started writing songs so early, because I didn't start writing songs until I was in college. Like, I just didn't take a songwriting class, didn't know. I didn't think that that was a possibility until college. And it's like you start seeing people your own age writing songs and just like playing songs. And it's like you kind of start feeling like, okay, this is what I want to do. Who was that artist for you that you saw as like, oh, if they're doing it, I want to do that too, because that's it.
Oh. It was a progression. I'd say like early years, I was just all about classic rock, Beatles, Elton John, Carole King, that kind of stuff. But then when I became like teenager, I was really into emo music.
Awesome.
And so like Something Corporate was like my ultra favorite band. And that's a piano based kind of pop punk rock band.
Right.
So I started, you know, once I was more 14, 15, the style I was writing was kind of like Dresden Dolls, cabaret, pop punk. And I had a band with a drummer. She was like a metal drummer and it was me on the piano. And we were just like, rah!
Well, you know, it's cool because those are the ages that you're kind of listening to the same music as your peers. Your friends are showing you like, you know, tapes or CDs of songs that you're like, what is this? And you're influenced by all of that. So you started a band pretty young.
Yeah, about my freshman year of high school when I was like 14 or 15.
And were you still gigging with your brother by this, like at the same
time? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we're still doing weddings.
So you learned like the gigging scene way long ago.
Yeah.
Gigging scene. It's like, you know, and I didn't start that until I was out of college starting.
Wow.
And you know, it is something that it is a discipline. So did you ever feel like, okay, I'm getting tired of this, there's got to be more? Or were you just like, this is great, I'm getting paid to do what I want, this goes towards everything and part of my career? Because that's what you know, now you know this, it's like you're doing a lot of these private gigs, every artist is, so that you can facilitate doing your next record, so you can facilitate doing the tour, the festivals, the road gigs. So those gigs are like bankrolling all of that, which is the best. So
yes,
kind of know that back then, or were you kind of just like happy to just do gigs whenever they came by?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Back in the day, I was doing the weddings with my brother, And that was kind of like my money maker. And then the gigs with my project were not money making. I was like, you know, taking anything because I just wanted to play and get my music out there. And we were opening for like really grungy metal bands at this like hole in the wall venue in downtown St. Louis that I can't believe my parents even like let me go to.
That's awesome.
But yeah, we like started getting a name in that scene and opening for like national touring acts, which was really cool. You know, and I'm like 16 years old, little emo kid. And so I was a purist of like, I'm just going to do my original music and that's it. But then when I was 18, about to go into college, I got offered a gig that was like $300 for a duo. And I'm like, you mean they're just going to pay me that? Like, really?
Right.
And I forfeited my original intention of only original music so that I could start making money, like gigging in restaurants and bars and, you know, that whole scene. And so
there's something silly about that to me. It's like, it's so weird that somebody will pay. And I just went to Coachella. So a Justin Bieber, he got $10 million for that performance, which is crazy. He made $5 million on merch each weekend, okay? So, and you know what's crazy, too, is he sat up on the stage. He sold his publishing for $290 million. I'm giving you all the info. And so he couldn't play his tracks that he sold to, you know, he sold his publishing to. So he sat with a laptop and looked up songs of his, and he just started singing along or playing, like, acoustic versions. No full band. I mean, this is like in front of 125,000 people. So it just is weird that the money, because of the marketing, he would get 10 million. And then, you know, an artist that's unknown is encouraged to take a cover band gig where it's like, oh, you can make a couple thousand dollars doing this or a couple hundred dollars doing this. And then an original artist that has amazing songs that are probably better, and your songs are better than anybody that I know you're covering, you're not encouraged by the financial carrot that you should be. You know, it's like really strange to me. So, talk to me because I mean, I have so many questions because I think that's so crazy to me. It's like the cover band scene is like this certain market, but original artists aren't encouraged to be original artists until they're over-marketed like a Justin Bieber to get to that level. Tell me what your perspective is on that, because I'm so curious.
Yeah, it's really depressing. And I also, I coach singers and aspiring artists. And like, that has been such a frustrating thing for me to deal with, not only in my own career, but like, as I'm coaching them and we're like working on their songwriting, we're working on their branding, and they're just like stoked, like, oh, I'm going to go be an artist, and they want to quit their job and go full send it into music. And I'm like, you can, but you're probably also going to have to do the cover thing. And some of my students, they would try, you know, to do that, but it felt like they were, their soul was getting sucked, because that's not why they went into music. They went in to be an artist and that's it, you know? And so they go back and take their normal job and then keep doing their art on the side. But like for me, I don't mind doing the cover gigs because I just see so many people in the audience like light up with joy because they're hearing their favorite songs, and we get to do like sing-alongs and have this kind of like cute moment, and it makes me happy to bring people joy. So
yes,
there's that. And then always I'm sneaking in my original music into my set, and then people are like, oh, you write too? And then, you know, I kind of like try to bring it all together and use it to my advantage, you know?
Yes, yes. What we would do is we would play cover band gigs and we would play 90% originals. And how we'd get away with it is we would do an original song, and then we'd put a Peter Gabriel quote in between the next original song. So, like, there would be a big chunk of, like, a cover song in the middle, but we'd only do a verse and a chorus, and then we'd be soloing over the changes. And then it would lead into an original song. And so people would come up to us, including the bars, and be like, man, I really loved those three covers you did. And I'm like, yeah, cool, man. We would get away with doing originals that people thought were covers just because we put a couple little covers in there. So I think you should switch it up. Instead of sneaking in an original, you should sneak in a cover.
I love
that. Sandwich it with your originals, because your originals are every bit as good, if not better, than any songs you're covering, because your songs are awesome. So that's why I'm asking an artist like you all these questions, because I feel like it's become harder for the next generation of artists than when I was coming up. And it's like I was doing a lot of work professionally as a kid when it was like the last part of the heyday of the music industry. So I was a kid coming up in that part of the industry. And when I graduated college, the music industry was crumbling. Like Napster was coming about. We're on the way out. And you just could see the writing on the wall a little bit. So for an artist like yourself, I feel like the generation of artists like us, like, you know, before you, we kind of went through such a crazy struggle. And you're going through an even shorter stick of what is left of the music industry. And I'm so amazed that you're still kind of like just doing it, because that's what it takes. It takes an artist just to be like, I'm going to do it no matter what to get through all the bullshit, because yes, artists like you are what people should be listening to on the radio, at parties, listen, you know, sharing records. And I hope people are doing that. And that's one of the reasons I wanted you on my show, because I just stumbled. Like, you and I met at NAMM, and then you sent me your stuff. And, you know, I meet a lot of songwriters. I'm like, yeah, let me get you on my radio show. And I checked out your music, and I was like, wow, you are a real artist. Like, it is night and day that you kind of know that you, when you see you, you're like, oh, she's been doing this for a long time. Like, there's no substitute for that time that an artist puts in. And you can tell. So I just have so many questions, because I love that you still love gigging the way you do, because that's the part that, you know, I'm 20 years into this, and there are gigs where I'm like, I will not do it anymore. I just will, like, I'm going to draw the line, because I just don't want to be a jukebox, or I don't want to do a certain gig for, you know, like whatever the money is. But it's so hard, because there is survival, and there is, like, you have to do certain things to just keep the wheel turning. And there are certain gigs that you have to do to keep the wheels turning, keep the lights on, so to speak. So tell me what inspires you about the current music scene. We'll talk about that. And then tell me a gripe that you have about the music scene, because I want to know the real deal, because that's what it's really about. I want to know what a younger artist like yourself is going through that people should know about, and why people should support an artist like you.
I want to add real quick to your point before of saying no to gigs. I always have three things I look for in a gig, which is that the pay is good, the people are cool.
Yep.
And then it's like doing something to further my bigger dream of being an original music artist, right? And so I have to have at least two of those very strongly checked off if I'm going to say yes to a gig.
Yes.
And that's been helpful for me to really, like, get honest with myself of.
Did a jazz musician tell you that? Because that's what my jazz musician bandmates were like. Two of the three have to be there. It's got to be the music, the hang, or, like, the whole the vibe of what it is. Like, you know,
yeah,
money, the people, the music. Two of the three have to be great.
A producer I worked with in LA back in 2017 told me that, and I was like, yes, I love that. I'm going to live by that from now on.
Yeah, it's like you, because, like, there are great money gigs that are, like, soulless, and I've done many of them, and you're just like, oh my God, I'm grateful for the pay, but this is painful to get through. And then there are gigs where it's like, man, I'm not making what I made on that last gig, but listen to what's happening with the exchanges that are happening on stage between musicians, and it's just fun beyond measure. And, you know, I've worked with assholes. I've worked with amazing people. And as I get older, I have less and less tolerance for working with anybody that's just not cool, not down to earth, not fun to be around.
Yeah.
And also being on the road too, like traveling, you learn real quick. Can I travel with these people long term? Because that's like traveling with family. It's like taking a family trip.
Yes.
It's like all business. So you learn, like, who can I, you know, spend these hours with? Who can I go through adversity with? Because you will go through canceled flights and all kinds of things that you have to deal with where it's like, okay, I don't know if I can handle these these canceled layovers or whatever with these people. So how has that been for you when you've been gigging or just going on this journey?
Working with other people.
Yes.
I definitely feel exactly the same as you, that like, I can't deal with the big egos. It's just not fun when someone takes themselves so seriously. Right. I'm like, I'm a jokester. I love having fun. I take things very lightly, you know, and seriously at the same time, like when it comes to the actual like art and performance. But when I'm on the road, I want to be playful and fun. And so I've definitely like, I've worked with some insanely, amazingly talented, highly decorated musicians on the road in some of these jazz projects I've toured with in the past. And it definitely was, there were rubs there in personalities, but now it's cool because I have my band of my chosen people who I adore. And we actually just did a little tour in the Midwest and spent, you know, 9 hours in the car together. Amazing. Talking about everything from pyramids to conspiracy theories to like nerdy jazz things.
I don't know if you guys do this, but I love the listening sessions.
Yes.
Musicians like, have you heard? And it's a record that you haven't heard. That's probably my favorite time of being on the road or being, you know, in a car with musicians or anybody, where it's like, oh, let me show you this record. And then everybody's listening to a record that maybe only one person has heard in the car. And it is such an experience that everybody knows they've just been changed. You know, like those are my favorite moments. Or it's like a theory, like maybe it's a philosophy on something or a movie or just funny things, antics and whatnot. So you hit it right on the head. It's those conversations that can make you feel like, okay, these are my people. This is my tribe. And you can tell when somebody's not on that vibe real quick too.
Mm-hmm.
you know all this stuff. So let's play one of your songs. What do you want to play first? Let's play one of the videos.
Let's see. I gave you Living for Myself and Other Side.
Yes.
Right? Let's start with Living for Myself because it's on this topic somewhat. I wrote this song right after I had a meeting with this kind of like high level music. He was kind of like an agent,
right,
manager, fellow. And I met with him and he's like, you know, you're really talented and da da da, but I just like don't know where to put you because you're doing like R&B and jazz, but then you're doing like Americana music and then you're doing this. And I'm like, what are you? Right. And I said, I'm all of that.
Right.
Like that's all me. And he's like, well, you need to pick a lane if you want to be successful.
No, don't ever listen to people like that.
You know, and he's like, you just got to lean into one of those heavy. And I was like, I don't think so. Like, that's just not who I am. And we just kind of like went back and forth. I mean, at the time I was being very respectful and not totally speaking up for how I felt.
Right.
So when I got home, I was like kind of feeling all of this like rage inside of me. And I sat down at the piano and this song just like poured out of me. saying, like, I'm a canvas of many colors. You can't define me just by one. And like, I'm tired of jumping through all your hoops and I'm going to play by my own rules. So it was all like born out of my rage against the capitalist machine of the music industry.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Here's Lola Christine with Live For Myself.
It was a blue note. Yes.
Tell me that you don't think I know who I am. Well, who do you think that you are? I am a canvas of many colors. You can't define me just by one. Maybe I'm a little bit angry sometimes, though I like to pretend I'm oh so sweet. Here you're coming and you're seeing through my lies. Finally
incredible. If you are not a believer after that, then you just have no heart and soul. That's how I feel about that. My goodness, what a song, what a voice, what a whole vibe. Tell me what the inspiration was. You said earlier it was about, you know, kind of putting that rage into a song, but tell me how it kind of blossomed into this beautiful feeling song that you recorded and arranged and produced. Tell me what that feeling was like.
I mean, this song, so this is from my last record called Chapters, which most of the album was done via like everyone's home studio and sending tracks back and forth and all of that. And that's just kind of like how I was going about it, low budget life, you know? Yep. But for this song, the way I heard it in my head was just like rock and roll, like in like live, vibing off each other in the room. And so I wanted to do this song in the studio, playing live, so that we could have that energy. And so this is the only song on the record that was recorded that way.
Wow.
And I think it was the right choice because you can feel it in the recording, just the intensity of everyone in the space together and playing off each other and shredding some rad solos, you know?
What was, you can feel it's palpable, and it's also it's refreshing, like to hear somebody so young like yourself have so much soul and have so much fire, and the players are like extensions and singers are extensions of that, and you can hear it in the room. Did it make you want to make every song like this in the future or have more records like this?
It was definitely like eye-opening because it was so much faster, the whole production on this song, because it's literally just, we did take four. Like we used take four from the session and that was it. I didn't have to go comping like crazy, you know?
Right.
And what was good for me, I can be a bit of a perfectionist. And when it's like, I was producing everything. So people would send me, you know, their five bass tracks or five drum parts or whatever. Then I'd be going through and like picking my favoritest moments from each take. Nice. And it would take forever, you know, and it's like, I do believe there's a beauty in letting go of the perfectionist aspect, especially in today's world with AI music taking over, which is, you know, very perfect and very on the grid. And I think there's a lot of beauty in the push and pull of how someone actually plays music, how a human feels the beat. It is not like a robot. And so with the new record I'm working on, it's, I'm definitely leaning more and more into like the organic, raw human sound instead of being such a perfectionist.
Did you play to a click for that performance, or was there no click?
We did, but it was more, I mean, the drummer Kyle is insanely talented, so he's able to stay locked in but not feel like he's, you know.
No, the reason I ask is like I have a YouTube series and we go into a studio, we bring in a special guest, and we record like 3 to 6 songs live. And we have to play to a click in case there is a solo that was like ridiculous on take 5 that we will end up putting in there that we have the footage of. But most of the time, it's like 99% of the time, we're just playing another take. We're going to do one more take and just get the whole take as it is. And it's so hard to not, to just, it's so hard to abandon the click. Like I want to all the time. I'm like, let's not do the click. But if there's some part that you ever want to edit, that's your safety. But I also hate it because, man, I just wanted to always have the same feel and the time and the groove and the clicks. It saves that. That's why I asked, because I don't love, I mean, we always record to a click, but it's also like in those situations, it can kill some of the vibe a little bit. You know, it's like, it can make it where it takes it and makes it static, you know? So you don't feel that in this. So how do you know when a song or a take is done? This is an artist question that I always obsess over. Ask, like, because I know you are, you know, a lot younger than me, and it's also you are probably in that place where you do want it perfect. You do want it, you know. So, like, how do you, you know, they say art is finished when it's abandoned. How do you know when to abandon the art?
Oh, I love that.
Isn't it great? It's the truth, though. It's like, I have records. I kind of make a rule for myself where it's like, I don't ever spend more than a year on a record. Never. Mm. Like 9 to 10 months from inception of we're in the studio to mix and mastering, it's usually 9 months. And I try to always stay on that because I could spend 5 years on a record. I know you can too, but you lose sight of it. You lose sight of it that way. So I just make sure I don't do that. And it's hard. So you have to abandon it. How do you know when it's time to abandon the song?
Oof, that's a hard one. And I'm dealing with that right now in this new album I'm making. I actually literally sent a text before this saying that this one song's ready to go to mixing, which means, you know, in a certain sense, it's out of my hands now.
Yeah.
And the production element of it, the, you know, all the things that I can mess with are, that's done. Right. And now it's just going to get to sound better. But that it's a hard one to know when you're done. But I think for me, it's like a gut feeling that I listen to the song. And of course, there's always going to be little things that you're like, that could maybe be a little better, or that could be a little cleaner or whatever. But to me, it's a feeling thing that, like, is this moving me? Is this compelling me? Like, do I feel like the lyric is getting painted in a way that's like going to impact listeners, and that's going to make it just like this cohesive experience of the storytelling with the music complementing with the way I sang it, all of it together. Yeah, I'd say it's so much to do with that, with the lyric. And that's why if I get too much in perfectionist mode, that's when I think you lose the magic, because it's not about the heart and soul of the song anymore. It's about being this like cookie cutter version of what you hear on the radio or whatever, you know?
I find that it's also like, I think when I was younger, I was obsessing over mixes, like where you're not really sure, but you're like, maybe it needs this. And then you try that, and then you start going down this rabbit hole. Now it's like, does it give me chills? If it doesn't give me chills, it's not there.
You know?
Old engineer, this is a great tidbit of wisdom I'm gonna share with you. He is one of my favorite engineers. He used to be Etta James and Van Morrison's guitarist.
Oh, come on now.
He's 4 years old. He had an all analog studio, and so no computers. And, you know, he kind of taught me, like, yeah, music, you shouldn't look at music. You should just listen to it.
Yes.
I love that. But he said, get a song or a recording to 98%. There's 1,000 ways to get it to 98%. It'll never be 100%. But once you get it to 98%, you know. And that has helped me curb some of my, oh, I don't need to obsess over this. It's at 98%. This is perfect. Great.
Yeah.
Because it allows you to kind of like distance yourself from overanalyzing, overmixing. Yeah, and I've done it. I've done 12 to 14 mixes on a song. I've done it.
Same.
I've done like 2 to 3 or 1 or, you know, but the songs that I savor and I look back on the most are the ones that are like scratch vocals, made it on the final record, or, you know, whatever it is. It's like the things that you did not ever think would happened. And it just became those magical moments that are imperfect and they're perfectly flawed. And that's what makes music just do its thing. So, I mean, that this is why I asked you, because when I was younger, I was so obsessed over making it perfect. And the perfect records that I have made are so far from perfect. And the imperfect records I've made are closer. You know what I mean? It's like,
yes.
So it's like you realize that the flaws are what make you human, and the perfection is not something that's attainable, and it just falls flat. So especially with the music that you're doing, the same music that I'm doing, it's one of those things where it has to be organic, it has to be real. So when you're in that place of mixing, or when you approve something, how do you distance yourself to get to that place where you're like, okay, it's done? Tough.
It is tough.
I know. I always listen to your own records and you're like, I could have done that.
Oh yeah.
I could have. Yeah. You know,
but you know, Rick Rubin, have you read his book, The Creative Act?
I've met him twice, but I have not read his book.
It's great. And he's got so many nuggets of wisdom in there. And one of them was talking about how you have to be willing to like have the baby, so to speak, and then let the baby go into the world.
Right.
And then start working on your next baby. Right. And like, you can't keep, once you let that baby go, it's now you're opening yourself up for whatever's next.
Right.
And so put your energy into whatever's next and keep directing that. And that's been helpful for sure in releasing, like, okay, that's where I was at the time. And yeah, it could have been better, but that's just, it's a reflection of that period of my life. And that's beautiful.
Yes.
And like, that's what I don't want to lose ever in the creative process, is getting it to a place that no longer is true to who you are in that moment. And so the more you it can be in the moment, the more authentic, even if it's not perfect by whoever's standards, it's like, this is a realistic reflection of who you were in this time and space. And that is the beauty of art.
Yes. I love that. Yes. And I think it's important that, I think there's a letting go. I'm sure you feel this. Every time I make a record, there's a part of me I'm letting go and let live in that record.
Yes.
Like it makes me feel like, oh wow, I've left something with the world that makes me feel like I'm stronger, I'm more confident, I'm more of who I need to be, but because of that record. So it's like this, it's this weird process, and I'm sure you know and feel the same way, where it's like you make something and you're putting all of yourself into this for this finite amount of time, and then as soon as it's done, it's like you shed that layer of yourself, and now you're working on shedding the next layer to kind of like put into a listening experience for people. But it's just such a crazy, it's kind of a beautiful thing about being an artist where we're allowed to do that. I have a friend that he's a painter, and he taught me something. He was actually on the show, and he said, you know, the weird thing about painting is we put all of ourselves into the art, and then we sell the piece and never see it again and don't get to experience it in the same way for sometimes a decade. And I was like so blown away by that notion, because like we make a record, we get to live in that record forever. We can still listen to it, experience it. It's right there. But a painting, you know, if I spend 5 months on a painting, not that I paint, but he did, and then sold it, you may not see that painting again for 8 to 10 years, which has happened to him. And he said, I went back and revisited a piece that somebody had in their house that I hadn't seen in 8 years. And it was like, I got to experience it with that distance, which is such a crazy thing, because I know, like, as you make songs and records, when you have that distance, you look back on the records with a little bit more, you're more open to all the positives that the record was, and like so many of the criticisms just fade to nothing. So
totally.
So it's like what's interesting is like we get to experience it, but we go back and listen and we can get right back to that. But do you have that moment when you listen to your old records where you're like, man, I don't feel those same mistakes or criticisms in my head when I listen to this now. Because now I'm looking back and I'm like, all the things that I wanted to fix back then, I don't even remember. You know, it's like, you remember, but they don't matter. But
they don't matter. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you totally feel records? Are you starting to get time and distance away from them where you're starting to experience that?
Yes. Yeah. And sometimes I like, you know, when I'm in town in St. Louis, my parents love to listen to my music, which is so cute. And
mine too.
And I'll like hear a song of mine that I haven't heard in a long time. And I'm like, whoa, that was like dope production. I forgot I did that.
Right.
But it was such a cool choice, like such a cool moment. And so I do find that the distance gives me these like, wow, I surprised myself, even though yes, I did it and spent hours and hours doing it. It's like you forget the beautiful things you created, and then hearing it with that distance, it just, yeah, I feel like you're way less hard on yourself, and you're experiencing it more like how everyone else is probably experiencing it as a general listener.
Almost like you're ahead of the curve when you make the art, and then you're completely behind the curve because what you just said, you're experiencing it now the way people listen to it, but they've already had that experience. So now you're behind it like, oh, wow, this is so cool. I'm getting to hear it like this now, you know? So it's interesting. Let's play something else. What do you want to play next?
Ooh, let's, we have time for all three, right?
Yep.
Cool. Let's do the other side. We'll save the new one for last.
Okay.
So Other Side is a song I co-wrote with Justin Bush, who you know.
Yes, yes, awesome.
And it was a pretty trippy experience. I had this dream about, basically in my dream, I was still in my house I was living in at the time, but I like everything was iridescent, beautiful colors, sparkling, alive. And I felt this blissful joy in my body. And it was like I was experiencing heaven, but here in real time on Earth. And I had this realization in the dream of like, this is available all the time. I just am blind to it.
Right.
And then I woke up from the dream like teary-eyed with bliss, and I still felt the feeling in my body. And that day I had a writing session with Justin, and I walked in and he's like, I've got this idea for a song that's like, meet me on the other side. And I'm like, oh, cool, let's run with it. And so we were writing the song, and then on the chorus I like had the realization, I'm like, we're writing this song like about the dream I had last night about experiencing heaven on Earth, and that you can access that freedom at any time when you remember the truth of who you are and what this whole place is, the illusion of it, and that you are free from it and free from the suffering. It's available at all times.
Right.
And then when you're there, it's funny. It's like you just laugh at like, oh my gosh, I was taking myself so seriously and thinking, yeah, I was drowning in the things of this world, but it wasn't true. And so this song, it was a big like healing awakening moment for me. And it's been fun to play it live because a lot of people think that it's about, you know, people on the other side, people who have passed on, and that they like the song is from someone's perspective who has passed on and saying like, don't worry everyone here on Earth, it's going to be fine.
Right.
But my whole point is no, that's available here and now. Kingdom of Heaven is within you and it's here and now, you know?
I love that.
Well, yeah.
Here's Lola Christine with The Other Side.
Thank you.
between what is wrong and right, finding the mean in between the lines. Let's go swimming in the stars, flowing like a river on through the sky. Darling, won't you meet me on the other side?
Just awesome. Fun fact, I wrote a song called The Other Side as well, and it is a very special song for me, and it's kind of the difference of going from, like, depression to the other side of, like, just being uplifted. So it's like, it is exactly what you said. It's like you can find that realm here. I want to play your last song. This is something off your new record?
Yes, and this is not mixed yet.
Okay, that's all right.
But I was like, I just want to put something from the new album on here and share that with you.
Well, where can people find you? We're going to play it on the way out. Where can people find you online if they want to follow you on all the platforms? Where can people find you?
At Music of Lola on all social media, YouTube, everything. And my website's musicoflola.com. And then streaming Lola Christine with a K.
I was going to start the show with, hey, 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 Lola.
There we go.
Hello, I know she's heard that 1,000 times. All right, we're going to play this song on the way out. I just want to say, Lola, your music's amazing. We have got to play shows together. We've got to write some songs together. You are an amazing singer-songwriter. I want nothing more than the doors of opportunity for your music and you to be opened just wholeheartedly. So Thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. You have an open call to be on this show whenever you have a new record, whenever you have new songs you want to share. I hope you always come back because your music is amazing. It really is.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And I definitely will be back in a few months when I have some more of this new stuff done.
Well, we're going to play. This is Unravel, correct?
Yes.
Here's Lola with Lola Christine's music. Is amazing. Check it out on all platforms. Music at Music of Lola on every platform you can imagine. And we're going to play a little bit of Unravel by Lola Christine. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Lola, we're going to sign out right now because that's the way it should be. Here's a little bit of Unravel.
Once I take the pressure off, what is it that drives me on? If it's not the fate and fortune, I need to be loved, can I still write a song? If nobody's listening, will I still sing from the deepest part of me? A lifelong battle. Whoever said it'd be easy, taking a chance, putting your heart out on the line. I was made to face these shadows of my own design. And I know it's not easy to choose every day, keeping your heart open and your eyes. Favorite escape. If it's not you, a broken system's in place, then who is there left to blame? It's time for diving deeper, crouching low as I can, jumping up until I find a new place to land. A lifelong battle to unravel. Whoever said it'd be taking a chance, putting your heart out on the line. I was made to face these shadows of my own design. And I know it's not easy to choose every day, keeping your heart open and your eyes wide awake to be the one that you've been called. Just dive deep. Slow down, baby, we can climb to the highest peak. Slow down, baby, just dive deep. Slow down, baby, we can climb.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.